Welcome everyone to the season finale of the Caribbean Science Fiction Network, a celebration of all things fantasy, folklore, speculative fiction, and of course, science fiction. I have with me today Brandon O'Brien, the writer from Trinidad and Tobago.
How interesting and therefore how funny would it be if the fantastical creatures that are acknowledging that power and that access were also the product of a kind of racism that removes blackness from presence in the genre.
Today we'll be talking about his collection of poems, Can You Sign My Tentacle?
What does it say about our ability to access power? What does it say about the power that we have and how we use it? What does it say about that foundational assumption of the Lovecraft mythos that we are small and insignificant in the face of these large, powerful, things that they literally ignore us? What if they cannot ignore us? What if we actually did something cool and they went, hey, that's cool?
So Brandon, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so very much for having me. I'm very excited to have this chat with you.
Now, this is a special one, not only because of the season finale, but it's the first time I get to chat with a poet. Of course, you're also a writer of fiction. So how did you decide on a collection of poems?
The funny thing about this collection is that it wasn't the collection that I initially prepared to write. The very first poem in the collection, Pastor Asks for Donald Glover's Autograph, I had already written it a couple of months before for a performance that I did to support another magazine. I started like scribbling out some other stuff, wondering if there was a theme that was worthy of being explored there. In the writing of those other poems, I not only discovered what those poems could potentially mean or what those poems could potentially say, but it helped me understand a great deal more about the genre as a whole and about the role that marginalized writers and especially black writers serve in that space. It was only through like experimenting with that I discovered that it was potentially interesting, and I decided I was going to put those things together, and that's how it kind of molded.
Off of that point about experimenting with the form of poetry, there's also experimenting with Cthulhu. So talk to us about Cthulhu. Why was this important? What were you trying to get at?
Cthulhu is one of those obvious kind of foundational reference in science fiction, fantasy, and horror. People speak about Lovecraft's work very highly, but it also bears repeating for a lot of people who know it but don't want to admit it very often, that H.P. Lovecraft was historically quite racist as an individual. But he's also written some of the most obviously foundational characters in horror, the entire Cthulhu mythos. And I thought that was a very interesting juxtaposition to make as a result, that if I was going to write a book about blackness, about what it means to be black and accomplished, to have some level of power or access, how interesting and therefore how funny would it be if the fantastical creatures that are acknowledging that power and that access were also the product of a kind of racism that removes blackness from presence in the genre? What if a rapper was on his way to a gig and is asked for an autograph by this like large tentacled creature going, hey, I love your stuff, because that's just a very obviously hilarious image. But also, what does it say about our ability to access power? What does it say about the power that we have and how we use it? What does it say about that foundational assumption of the Lovecraft mythos that we are small and insignificant in the face of these large, powerful, looming things that are so great and so unmatched that they literally ignore us? What if they cannot ignore us? What if we actually did something cool and they went, hey, that's cool?
Now, this collection has a very strong musical feel to it. There are references to American rappers, and there are also some famous Calypsonians. There are references to Lord Kitchener, there's the Mighty Sparrow. So talk to us about the use of music, these musical figures in this collection.
A lot of my writing process is around music. I listen to music a lot. Sometimes a song will trigger a scene that I want to put in a story or a book. While I was still trying to figure out who are the individuals that matter in this collection, what are the figures of blackness that I wanted to rely on, it kind of dawned on me that for the most part, the only people that I could draw on with some kind of attention were musicians and other writers. And I didn't want to put other writers in the book because I didn't want them to feel like I was calling the name out my mouth. So I decided to rely on the musical image. Firstly, because there's always these kinds of assumptions about what that kind of money and power does to a person. And I kind of wanted to speak a lot to those because I think that it's not always true, but when it is true, it is uniquely telling about those individuals. What all of those kinds of assumptions does for that individual, does for the interaction that they're having when that autograph is asked for. One of my favorite poems in the collection, but the one that I'm so ashamed of, because if the rapper in question saw it online, they'd probably get very upset. There is a poem in the collection called Cathilla Asks for J. Cole's Autograph, which is just about the kinds of naturally misogynistic assumptions that are tied to hip-hop, even when the performer is uniquely trying to reject a kind of misogyny, and what that kind of does for the way people assess that rapper, the way that people assess that rapper's relationships with the women that they are close to, etc. That was giving me room to have that kind of conversation in a way that I thought was particularly interesting. And I think that every musician in the collection is giving me one of those things. As you mentioned, there is a poem where the Mighty Sparrow and Lord Melody feature, and it leads in my head to Sparrow writing Obia Wedding and Melody writing Creature from the Black Lagoon. I was just like stricken by the idea of what kind of inspiration strikes Calypso artists and how. And what if that inspiration was just, oh, we witness these kinds of things all the time. This is not new to us, the weird and fantastical and intense relationships that we have to the world are normal and commonplace. And we are writing what is essentially reportage. We are not making these things up. And I thought that was kind of interesting as well.
In addition to some current musical figures that you reference in the poems, you also look to more traditional cultural forms, in particular the folklore characters, the Lagahu, the Sukiya, but you give their side of the story. So what were you trying to achieve by telling their side of the story?
I think the thing that I am trying to get the most, trying to like understand and appreciate the most about folklore is there is this automatic assumption, not just about folklore in Trinidad and Tobago, but folklore anywhere, that, well, you tell these stories because you want children to come back home before it gets dark. You tell these stories so you know that children behave in certain ways and learn certain lessons. So the assumption must be that these things are cruel and violent and brutal and unnecessarily harsh and will just do harm to anyone. But what if instead there is this kind of folkloric language of someone only gets what they deserve, and there are fantastical creatures whose job it is to balance the scales of justice because the rest of the world does not or cannot. I think in particular as well about the La Diablesse, which we automatically assume in a certain way is actually quite just, because the La Diablesse as a character goes out and seeks men to destroy. But we never actually ask the question, well, what the fellow was doing there though? And if in the middle of the forest you suddenly get bazoodie for a woman that you do not know, who is all alone in the forest, what does that actually say about you? Maybe you kind of deserve to get a lick up. And in much the same way, I've been thinking about how you can view the Lagahu through the same lens. I'm kind of very excited to continue doing that because it's been particularly very fulfilling for me as an individual, first and foremost, and not as a writer, to re-explore that. And I want to be able to share those kinds of explorations with others.
Now, this collection was a very fast read, and I just read everything. In particular, the author's note, you threw out this idea of what it means to think of blackness as radically different. I wanted us to talk about that in relation to having a Caribbean identity. And what does it mean to think radically different about being Caribbean?
In the author's note, which was like a very difficult thing for me to stop and write in hindsight, as you mentioned that relationship to Caribbean identity as well, I like stopped to trace my steps back to the creation of this collection. And I guess like one of the questions that I try to ask as a result in these poems are, well, what are these people doing that is special? And I don't want to say to prove one's worth, because everyone is worthy, but to prove one's worth to a world that thinks that you are unworthy, precisely because the world already doesn't care about you and is looking for excuses to continue not to. And through the lens of Cthulhu, through the lens of the Lovecraft mythos as a result, there is this like unique juxtaposition of, well, the world is so big and so grand and so powerful that it has exerted the same kind of effort to devalue Black voices and make us feel small. And I think the contradictory comparison between that fact that the world doesn't care about you and is looking for excuses to continue not caring about you, and that the things that you do to survive as a result make you so much grander and so much more obviously worthy that the universe goes, hey, that was actually kind of neat. How do you observe that? And what are the things that you can learn from observing that? It's one of the reasons, one of the things that I was trying to experiment with in the book.
Now we should talk about time, because in this collection, there are different ways of perceiving time. And one of my favorite poems that touches on time is The Metaphysics of a Wine. Now on this podcast about science fiction, I want to get your thoughts on how this collection is allowing us to perceive time in different ways.
Time is actually a secondary observation of the way that we view relationships. And the reason why that mattered to me as a poet in particular is when you love someone or you feel like you've hit upon a remarkably powerful moment with someone, that is the moment when you realize, I don't actually have a lot of time in the world. At some point, this relationship might end. At some point, I might pass on or they might pass on. All kinds of things get in the way. We don't have enough time with each other. Each of the three poems that deal with that kind of relationship are unique in that way because they're about what we do with the time that we have or how we earn it. There is a poem in the collection called The One, which I love a lot because it is very mathematical, even though I hate maths, which is about a vampire who has been on the search for the one, the person that will make their life whole for literal ages, and stumbles upon this like unique relationship with this one young woman after like having almost given up on the experience of being immortal in the first place, and discover that, well, this is the thing that makes life worthwhile. The other poem that I adore a lot is about what happens when you actually do run out of time and then manage to scrape a little bit of extra moments with the one that you love after they have already passed on, and what you do with that time and how you cherish that time. And is it kind of frightening or upsetting and tragic even to know that you can still have those moments, but those moments will always be fleeting, just like they are in real life. And obviously, as you mentioned, Metaphysics of a Wine, which is about how magical a wine can be, but also about the ways in which we negotiate intimacy in the dance hall, and like what that means about our capacity to engage in intimacy overall. But it is uniquely marked by time. That wine have to end because the girl have to go home at some point. And all of those things are, I value those observations about time in particular, because poetry is a very good space to have a conversation about how fleeting our moments are and what we can do with them. And speculative poetry in particular is a very good space to like ask similar questions about, well, if you could make more time, what would you do with that time? How would you cherish the moments that you have with the people that you care about? So like writing those kind of unique and interesting poems about how we navigate intimacy with that kind of lack was just very interesting to me. As a result, it reveals like the thing that we know about both time and relationships, which is if you don't cherish it while it's here, it will stop being here at some point, and then yeah, the deal.
Another one of my favorite poems is That Business Called Utopia. I really feel that you was trying to tell us something. So I want to get the chance to pick your brain. What was the point of this poem? Give us some context to it.
This poem was being written during like some of the most awkward and tumultuous times in world history. The Trump election, the Trump presidency, the end of the Trump presidency. Upheaval in places like Venezuela and the UK with Brexit. And I couldn't help thinking about like the unique language that the genre has to observe these kinds of things is on a continuum between dystopia and utopia. But the funny thing about science fiction and fantasy as a genre is utopia is never utopian. Like, the nature of conflict in fiction is that a utopia has to be dystopian for someone somewhere. And that kind of observation was the one that I was having in my brain, that there are all of these people all over the world who think that the things that are happening in their spaces are good and just and noble. When I actually wrote That Business They Call Utopia Part 2, I was writing it on the night that the Brexit vote had been finalized and folks were literally like marching in the street and singing the national anthem in London. And I was like, but this isn't good. This is like people getting up out of their homes in the Star Wars franchise and singing the Imperial March. This is not a noble moment. This is actually quite tragic and unfortunate. And it's unfortunate that people still have to learn that. And I'm not making any assumptions about what that experience is like for those people, because this is a kind of suffering as well. But what does it mean for the people who have to live in those worlds, and especially marginalized people who have to live in those worlds, with that assumption that a good thing is happening here, that this is a thing worth celebrating, that these are the ways in which we are supposed to behave? What kind of people are we? Not just as any nation anymore, but as humans, what kind of people are we that we could make these kinds of obviously hostile, obviously hateful assumptions about other people? In the service of what, actually? Because this doesn't make us beautiful or noble. And I guess the question that came out of that poem is, well, what do you do when that happens as one individual, as people without political power, people without clout? What do we actually have as a tool to counteract that kind of behavior? And the thing that I settled on, which is obviously very poetic, the poem literally harkens back to Emily Dickinson, is hope that at some point, when more than enough people have realized that a thing is not good, the only two things that you have left are your hope and your rage. And if you're not going to share your hope and your rage with other people, then we're never actually going to get the thing done. And I still think that that's very important. I think a lot of the time we haven't been angry enough and used our anger in productive and helpful ways. And the thing that I hope people get from that poem, first and foremost, is that anger that you feel, that frustration that you are not living in the world that you think you're supposed to, is supposed to motivate you to do the things that are necessary to make that space. And that you can do that by letting other people into that experience of knowing this is not ideal and we can make it ideal, because you can't do it by yourself or else you'll just be angry forever. But if you share that with other people, if you share that understanding that we can be better with as many other people as possible, then there comes the point at some point in the future where everyone around you only believes in that future. And I think that that's still, I think that even now that's still valuable. And I think that it's very difficult to figure out exactly how to do that. The poem doesn't give any answers, because I didn't have all of the answers at that point either. I still don't. But I still do think that that kind of anger, tapping into that kind of personal, emotional awareness that this is not good, that this is not ideal, but that we can make it ideal if we work together, is still valuable.
So Brandon, we're coming to the end of the chat and you've thrown up lots of things, but I'm going to give you one more chance to leave us with something.
If it had to be the one thing, it is that you are important, the people who are around you are also important. Every individual that you meet is making something or doing something that is radical, that is beautiful, that is significant. And even if it is not worthy of an autograph, it is worthy of acknowledgement, and you should acknowledge it as often as possible.
Now that's a way to end the season. Brandon, I want to thank you so much for doing this. And for everyone listening throughout this full season, I want to thank you so much as well. Look out for the next season of the Caribbean Science Fiction Network. Bye.